It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and online at www.rir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
I think you hear a running theme for me of the victim trying to reach out to tell people what's happening in her life, even if this is not the time to leave or to pursue a criminal or civil action.
Sushila Varkey, domestic and sexual violence attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, speaks about the needs, legal and otherwise, of victims and survivors of family abuse in the second part of a two-part interview. And during this week's News You Can Use, we explain why Virginia lawmakers did not protect K-12 education in the budget agreement passed back in September, despite the budget writer's assertions. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 250, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.rir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. What do housing opportunities made equal attorney Helen Hardiman, ACLU attorney Rebecca Glenberg, and foreclosure prevention attorney Henry McLaughlin all have in common? They've all appeared on WRIR within the past 6 months on this show. No other radio station in Richmond can make that claim. No other radio station offers WRIR's variety of underrepresented news, views, and music. If you like what you hear and want to continue hearing it, please call 622-9747 to make your gift or donate online at www.wrir.org to keep Law for the Rest of Us on Radio for the Rest of Us. Thank you. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Virginia lawmakers did not protect K-12 education in the budget agreement passed back in September, despite the budget writer's assertions. In fact, they cut general funds for K-12 education by more than $43 million this school year, while bandaging that wound with $15 million from the state's literary fund and $28 million from the Virginia lottery. While this may look like a dollar-for-dollar trade, it isn't. Only rarely can lottery profits and money in the literary fund be spent on anything but education. They're dedicated funds, and that's spelled out in Virginia's Constitution. Lawmakers have little choice on where that money gets spent. In other words, that money would have gone to education anyway, so schools are still $43 million poorer. But lawmakers did have a choice about how they use the general fund, and they chose to reduce how much goes to education. That's a cut. It's like scratching a winning lottery ticket and then being told that the amount of your winnings will be deducted from your other income. But hey, congratulations, you won. The situation is particularly bad when combined with the $30 million in annual cuts it inflicted on localities, which spends more than half of their budgets on schools. Sadly, this switcheroo is nothing new. Budget writers regularly raid the literary fund to help offset reductions in general fund support for teachers' retirement. It's perfectly legal, but still just disguises a cut in state general funds devoted to our schools. Voters were told that the state lottery would boost funding for K-12 education when they approved its creation in 1987. But year after year, those profits have been used to mask reductions in other state education funding. And that does nothing to help our schools. By June 2015, state aid per K-12 student will have dropped 17% from 2009 levels, partially as a result of budget gimmicks like this. It doesn't have to be this way. A more balanced approach to budgeting that includes new forms of revenue could go a long way toward helping our schools and avoiding some of the state's perennial budget woes. But as long as lawmakers rely on this cut-and-switch approach to make ends meet, they are gambling with our schools, our children's future, and our economy. Instead, lawmakers should focus on real ways to help stop the cuts for our students. That would be a winning ticket. See more at thehalfsheet.org, the blog of the Commonwealth Institute. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Legal education is legal empowerment and an essential part of the struggle for fairness, equality, and justice. Since 2005, WRIR has made programs like the Legal Aid Radio Show possible so you can hear what nobody else will broadcast. Whether it's unrepresented news, views, or music, WRIR is the only outlet for cultural diversity in Richmond, and you, our listeners, make it possible. Call 622-9747 to make your gift, or donate online at www.wrir.org to keep Law for the Rest of Us on Radio for the Rest of Us. Thank you. Since 1987, the month of October has been Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Sushila Varkey, domestic and sexual violence attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, speaks about the needs, legal and otherwise, of victims and survivors of family abuse in the second part of a two-part interview. So what I would like to talk about next are the legal options that victims of domestic violence, domestic abuse have. And I actually, even though we only do civil law at Legal Aid, want to first talk about the criminal law, because as you said earlier, if domestic violence were treated simply as a crime, that which it is, that right. would be a huge step forward. So what are the options there?
So let's say my husband hit me and I wanted to pursue a criminal case against him. What would happen? Maybe I'd call the police or the neighbors call the police. I might ask for a warrant, or the law enforcement can ask for a warrant from the magistrate for the crime of assault and battery against a family or household member. In Virginia, crimes are pursued or charged and pursued by the Commonwealth's attorney. It's not Sushila Varkey's case against her husband. It's the Commonwealth of Virginia's case against my husband for committing a crime. So in that criminal case, I might be a witness or the star witness, but there are times where, let's say, me going forward and testifying against my abuser might actually endanger me more. So I might change my story or not show up to testify or something like that. Even in those situations, the Commonwealth's attorney may have enough evidence from photos or other witnesses' testimony, 911 tapes, that they can go forward with the criminal case against my husband without my testimony. And that's a decision that the Commonwealth's attorney prosecutors are going to make, depending on the evidence that they have. The thing that can be helpful to me as a victim in that scenario where I'm not testifying is that it's almost like it's taken out of my hands. It's not me, husband, that's doing this to you. It's the state of Virginia that is pursuing this charge against you.
And you mentioned evidence, and could you talk to us a little bit about preservation of evidence, especially in the immediate aftermath of a domestic violence assault and battery? What should the victim do? I know they're not thinking about court or evidence right. or anything of that nature, but nevertheless, if they don't think about it, then the moment may have passed. So what would be the best course of action to preserve the evidence?
Well, they can take photos. Even if the police don't take photos, they can take photos of their injuries. They should keep a journal and write as quickly as possible after an event happens or after threats are made. The exact language or exactly what happened, the time, all of that can help with refreshing the victim's memory in the future if she does have to testify, in pulling the story together of what happened and what led up to that particular incident. I also think that keeping a journal of past history, it may not actually come out in evidence, but showing that pattern, you know, of this is the type of thing that he would do on a regular basis. I mean, I remember hearing in DC about this mediation, and generally speaking, mediation is not appropriate for people who are in a domestic violence situation because you have this one party having control and being able to manipulate the other party. But I heard about this case where the domestic violence wasn't identified, and in the mediation, the abuser would start tapping his fingers. Seems innocent to you and me, just tapping his fingers on the table. But that was a signal to his wife, when I get out of here, I'm going to beat you up, because that's what he would do. So I think being mindful of the details of what happened, taking photos, even, you know, and this is where the lawyers and the police are going to come in of gathering evidence, but if she ends up talking to someone, that excited utterance may be able to come into evidence through the other person because of the timing. It happened so quickly after the event. I think you hear a running theme for me of the victim trying to reach out to tell people what's happening in her life, even if this is not the time to leave or to pursue a criminal or civil action.
And I do get the running theme that isolation is basically the tool that the perpetrator uses to exert power and control, and sort of breaking that isolation is, right, is one of the ways out for the of the victim, for the survivor. We talked about the criminal side of what the survivor could do. What can, should she do on the civil side?
So that's an excellent question, because there are protective orders available for, frankly, for all people now who are experiencing violence. So the language is, if you have experienced an act of violence, force, or threat that results in bodily injury, sexual assault, or fear of death, then you can ask the court for a protective order. And if there is a family or household member relationship, that's what we call domestic violence in, by the way, in Virginia, it's called family abuse. So if there is the family or household member relationship, which means a number of things, but especially that the parties are married, they used to be married, they have lived together within the past 12 months as a couple, or they have a child in common. So any of those folks are considered family or household members, and they could seek protective order relief through the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court. Just backing up, right after a violent or threatening incident happens, a victim or the police can go to the magistrate to ask for an emergency protective order, and that lasts 3 days. Or if court's not in session, until 5 p.m. of the next court business day. And then at that point, if the victim feels she needs more protection, she can go to the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court to ask for a protective order. And the first thing she might ask for is a preliminary protective order, which lasts for up to 15 days, or when the next hearing is, for the full up to 2-year protective order. And protective orders can give some of the following relief. No contact. The respondent or abuser must not have contact with the victim. No further family abuse. No coming on the premises. So it can give the victim temporary possession of a home or an apartment. And then there's other relief that's available with the longer term protective orders, such as asking for child support or temporary custody, getting a jointly titled car or solely titled car, temporary exclusive possession of that. So there's a number of other types of relief. And Frank, actually in the 2014 legislative session, one of the additions is being able to protect and cover a companion animal in a protective order. And the reason that's so important is that often an abuser will use the family pet, the companion animal, to prevent the victim from leaving or threaten harm to the animal. So to be able to cover that animal in a protective order can be really significant to a victim being able to get full protection. Now, and I can talk more about all that relief, but I want to just back up and say that a protective order is not always the best option for a victim. It can actually escalate the violence, because if you think about it, if domestic violence or family abuse is about power and control, a survivor or victim using the court or law enforcement to defy her abuser and defy his authority can be very dangerous to her. Even if she could get a protective order, it may not always be the best option for her safety.
Which is an excellent segue to a question that I was thinking of, which was, the first step in the process, as you mentioned, is usually the emergency protective order, which can be asked for and obtained by the police from the magistrate.
Right.
That lasts basically, as you said, 72 hours, and then it's up to the survivor to decide to go for the preliminary 15-day order, the
right.
permanent, which can be up to 2-year order. And my question was, is there any reason why the survivor would not want to go forward with the preliminary and eventually the permanent order? You've partially answered
mm-hmm.
that. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's, let's say, in the example I used with myself, my husband beat me and the police came and did a report, found probable cause that an assault and battery against a family or household member occurred. They go and ask the magistrate for an emergency protective order. Let's say I wasn't sure if I wanted it, and they went and asked for it. I now have this order, but let's say they haven't served it on my husband yet. While the order is in the Virginia Criminal Information Network, the database that law enforcement can access and see and verify protective orders, serve them and enforce them using that database. Let's say it's in the database, but it hasn't been served on my husband yet. Having to serve him can take longer than the 3 days. So one, it's not actually effective under the law until he's been served with it. Yes, it can be enforced, especially if he shows up at the house and the police are asked to come. They can serve him with it then and explain the protective order to him. But that, again, she or I am defying my husband's authority. That can actually endanger me. And I'm realizing that now, let's say, that may be why I choose to not go to the court to get the 15-day or ask for the 2-year. That may have shown me that this is not the right time, or maybe a protective order is not the right tool for me to address my situation.
So what would be the right tool? What would be the alternative? I mean, especially if it is that magic moment, as you said, when the survivor realizes this is not working, this is not healthy for me, it's not healthy for my family, it's not healthy for my children. What is the alternative?
It's a very complicated answer because, and it may not be palatable for people to hear this, but the best thing may be to stay in the situation and try to manage it. Let's say I now realize, you know what? I'm actually a victim of family abuse, of domestic violence, and I need to develop a plan. The police getting this emergency protective order or me getting it for myself was not helpful. It actually escalated the violence, and now I feel like I have to manage things and de-escalate them and get back to that pattern that my husband and I were used to. It may mean sitting tight and going back to a routine, but still in my mind, starting the planning process of maybe this means I need to start looking for a job elsewhere where my parents live. Maybe this means reaching out to that friend that I had lost touch with 10 years ago who is a lawyer or who works at a domestic violence shelter or works for nonprofits and may be able to help me figure this out and at least start to develop a plan and talk through my options. So I know that's hard for people to hear, but that may be the best situation, the safest situation for a victim to just go back to the pattern everyone was used to. It may mean figuring out what school options are available in neighboring, you know, jurisdictions for the kids. You know, a protective order is not always the best thing, but trying to figure out how to protect yourself might be the best way to go.
And that goes a long way toward explaining what you mentioned last week, which was that the typical victim-survivor does leave 4, 5, 6, 7 times before it's the final separation.
Right.
Is that part of it, that you go back to that until you can really make the best possible plan to break out of this?
That may be part of it. It's also that this person, despite the monster he may become some of the time, is not always like that, right? You are in love with this person. You have children with this person. Maybe he is the primary breadwinner. He is actually a lovely person some of the time. It's not this sort of stereotypical green-eyed monster, right? So it's hard to leave someone you love, even when they do bad things to you. So that's part of it, too, being ready to say, I'm leaving this long-term marriage, this long-term relationship. This is the only relationship I've ever really known. I'm not comfortable being a single person. I mean, a lot of it is this psychological and emotional connection to this person you truly love. So that, I think we forget that. We forget that part of it because we just see the violence and the quote-unquote evil aspects of domestic violence. It's just not as clear-cut. So that's part of it, but not the whole picture.
Well, and that is definitely a perspective that too often gets ignored. And
exactly.
I appreciate you bringing that up. And finally, last week you mentioned resources for survivors of domestic violence, family abuse. What, again, are those resources?
So there's the Family Violence Hotline, which is run by the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance. It's 24 hours. And it is, again, you can go to the website vsdvalliance.org to get that information.
You've been listening to Sushila Varkey, domestic and sexual violence attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, speaking about the needs, legal and otherwise, of victims and survivors of family abuse in the conclusion of a two-part interview. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright, host of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. Remember when radio used to be real people spinning real records? Remember when news and talk programs used to be insightful and relevant? We at WRIR do too. WRIR DJs hand select the music they play each week. WRIR also features locally produced news and talk covering local, national, and international stories. We are Richmond Independent Radio, radio for the rest of us. And you, our listeners, make it possible. Call 622-9747 to make your gift or donate online at www.wrir.org. Thank you. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Personal bankruptcy, child custody, estate administration. You won't be informed about these issues anywhere other than this radio station, WRIR. If you want to continue hearing law you need to know to avoid getting ripped off, please call 622-9747 to make your gift or donate online at www.wrir.org to keep law for the rest of us on radio for the rest of us. Thank you. Virginia's Domestic Violence Protective Order statute cover both family abuse and non-family abuse. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Palma Pistolnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explains how to handle your own petition for a protective order in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on October 2nd, 2013. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wakeford.